We're discussing an extremist version of anti-racism in America and a new book that brings us to the terms third wave anti-racism and the elect. We'll unpack it all here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author John McWhorter makes the case that anti-racism words and actions, they have gone too far. It's performative, it's racist, and that most Americans' racial attitudes, that they have progressed massively beyond what they were a few decades ago. What do you think about the recent conversations about race and racism in America? Have they been necessary? Have they been unproductive? What does decentering whiteness mean to you? Join in 800-642-1234. John McWhorter is an associate professor of linguistics at Columbia University. His latest book is called Woke Racism: How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we should get this out into the ether right away, because you get this a lot, that you're just not black enough to write this book. You're not black enough to make these arguments. And how dare you? You get this a lot. So calling us in your book with the italics in this question, how have you settled on an answer?
Well, that's in the middle of the book, and it's just something that I put in because I think a lot of people would be thinking it. Some people would think it was impolite to actually ask the question out in the open. Some wouldn't. But it's an important question because there is an idea some people have that if you haven't grown up poor, or if you haven't grown up having run-ins with the cops, then your views on race are inauthentic. You haven't had the proper experience. And I want to make it clear that I definitely grew up very middle class. I grew up with two parents, and I am a very bourgeois cardigan-wearing person, without a doubt. But the way we're encouraged to talk about race is that anybody who's black undergoes a certain kind of ongoing oppression, including those of us who are reserved with PhDs. The idea is that there is a whiteness, there's this hegemony that's everywhere in the air and baked into the system, and to be black is to suffer. And it has nothing to do with whether or not you're a character from The Wire. So the idea that I just don't know because I didn't grow up poor, because I can't bust a move, et cetera, none of that makes any sense, because supposedly it is people like me, as well as other black people, who are eternally suffering from the racism in which all white people are complicit. So I just ask people to hear me out based on whether they agree with the logic of my views, rather than thinking that my views only make sense if I grew up poor and talk in a certain way, et cetera.
Some people would call your writing as against anti-racism, and therefore it would be racist, but you say there is a difference between being anti-racist and being anti-racist in a very hostile and cruel way. Can you explain what's going on and that difference?
Well, it's not only being anti-racist in a cruel way, because many people would say that racism is cruel, systemic racism is cruel, and therefore, who is anybody to say that you should be nice in battling it? The problem is that the way many people are being anti-racist these days, or teaching us to be anti-racist, is harming black people, because the anti-racism is about showing that you know racism exists, rather than doing things that actually help change the lives of people who are of a race. And so one thing that's very important is that the book that I wrote is not saying there's no such thing as systemic racism. There's this totem these days. The idea is, does she know? Does he know that there's systemic racism? See, there's the systemic racism. He's denying that there's systemic. No, I'm not. I am quite aware of what that is, what the inequities are that people are talking about. The question is not whether there's systemic racism. It's what you do about it. And we're being taught to do things in response to it that have nothing to do with helping people's lives, which is what I thought civil rights activism and progressivism were supposed to be about.
I think as a white woman, when you say that most Americans' racial attitudes have progressed a lot beyond what they were a few decades ago, it perhaps may release a little surge of dopamine in me. It feels good to hear that you do find progress, but I'm really fixated on the setbacks, and I worry about your sentiment in light of the achievement gaps between black and white students in Wisconsin, biggest in our country, and that Wisconsin incarcerates black residents at a higher rate than any other state. And then, you know, the 2016 election, so many black residents of Milwaukee waited hours in line because their polling locations were all closed. It's really hard for me to acknowledge progress with this type of reality. How do you square all of that? How do you see through that and find progress?
Well, yeah, woke racism is not a book saying, think about the progress and stop exaggerating. You could write a book about that. Some people have written a book like that. That's not what I'm saying. All the things that you mentioned are very real problems that deserve very concentrated solutions. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. So I do say in the book that things are much better than we're often told. And I say that because there is a way people tend to talk about racism these days, and that, including in your state, as if nothing has changed since 1960. And where that tends to lead is a tacit sense that it's cruel, for example, to expect Black people to live up to the standards that other people do, because we're just living under such relentless racism and oppression. We can't even walk by a rock, you know, without, you know, feeling like the rock is calling us a name, etc. That, I think, is exaggerated, but that's not the main point of the book. The point is, what do you do about the things that you mentioned? And often, don't be racist or battle racism doesn't solve those problems. And so, for example, with the incarceration, we have to ask, why are these men being incarcerated? Is it disproportionate? And in the meantime, what do you do about it? Mm-hmm. And fixing the racism that's baked into some attitudes in the criminal justice system, that would fix a tiny bit of this. But there are larger problems there that I think there are more pragmatic solutions for. But they're not always about telling people like you that there's something wrong with you, basically. That's not always what solves the problems.
We have linguist Professor Jen McWhorter, author of Woke Racism. You can join in. What do you think about recent conversations about race in America? Is America still a white supremacist nation, or have we made real progress? 800-642-1234. Let's bring on Christopher now and Cameron with thoughts. Hi, Christopher. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing this morning? Thanks for having me. So I would love to address the speaker's point on yeah, how there are still systemically racist institutions in the country. For example, disproportionate incarceration rates in the Black community. That's pretty well explained by a fellow named Thomas Sowell. He wrote an excellent book called Black Rednecks and White Liberals. And what he covers in that book is how basically in the mid-1960s, one of the things that happened when Lyndon B. Johnson passed the Great Society Act, what a lot of people don't know is that they were sending federal agents to Black communities, and one of the stipulations of getting on government assistance was you had to be in a single parent household. Now, Barack Obama himself has said correctly that your incarceration rate in a single parent household, regardless of race, is 20 times higher than if you're in a two parent household. So if you target a single community with a program that you can only have if you have a single family household, it's not surprising to see that crime goes up in just that community that you target. What I'm saying is if it had been white people, Mexican people, Asians, the same thing would have happened. So, I mean, one of the solutions to this is we gotta look at programs like that still exist that basically break families down. You know, in 1960, the Black community had the highest two-parent household rate in the nation. Now they have the lowest at 73%. They went from 24% of single-parent households to 73% households.
Christopher, I want to jump in here because Jen McWhorter explores this. Go ahead.
Well, you know, what it really comes down to is what happened between 1960 and 1970, because Christopher is pointing out something very important, which is that the two-parent family was not unusual even among poor Blacks in, say, 1960. By 1975, there was a situation that's unfortunately familiar to us now. And the reason wasn't that there's something wrong with Black people. What happened was that starting in 1966, there was an effort in many American cities, it started in New York and it spread outward, to get Black women who previously were not on welfare to sign up for it, even if they didn't know that they could use it. And indeed, being single was the idea. And that created a kind of Black community where it was a norm to grow up with one parent. Not the only norm, but it became unexceptionable and it became the usual case. The welfare revolution of the late 60s had a lot to do with that. That revolution was done by white people who thought that they were doing Black people a favor. And so it wasn't about racism, but it had a terrible effect on the Black community, and it created a lot of the kinds of discrepancies that we think about now, including boys who grew up fatherless, were more likely to commit acts of violence and come into contact with the criminal justice system at all. All of which is to say, these things are complex. And to just look at it in the present and say, racism, let's go battle the racism. Do you mean racism 50 years ago or racism now? Do you mean racism as a shorthand for disparity or do you mean racist bias? And then whatever you find, what are you going to do about it? This stuff takes, I think, harder work than a lot of our priests are telling us.
Author and linguist John McWhorter's latest book is called Woke Racism. How do you think we should talk to our children about the country's legacy of racism and violence against people of color? Do you get canceled for something you have said online? What happened? How did you respond? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with John McWhorter here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing anti-racism taken to the extreme, what it means for solving real problems of systemic racism in America. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author and linguist John McWhorter calls out, quote, New York Times reading, national public radio listening, people who have innocently fallen under the impression that pious, empirical, virtue signaling about race is a form of moral enlightenment. Are you afraid to criticize anti-racism programs for fear of being labeled a racist? Are you a person of color? What do you think about the current dialogue? 800-642-1234. The book is called Woke Racism, and John McWhorter is with us for the hour. Let's look at these three waves of the anti-racism movement in our country. How do you define these waves?
Wave was the classic civil rights movement. You get rid of legalized segregation. The second wave is one that wasn't officially labeled, but it was the vast change in attitudes among non-Black people in the 70s and 80s, where America learned that it's bad to be a racist. It's not something that you think of as ordinary and let pass. And so not only do you not have racism baked into legal structures, but also in your heart, you should see Black people as equals. There was a huge difference in how the typical white person, it tilted educated, but still, felt about that from 1960 to about 1985. There's a big shift. Now we have a third wave where America is being told that there's more work, quote unquote, to be done. And the idea is that what will save Black America is white people understanding their complicitness in an abstract sense in a system that historically has been set up in favor of whites and against Black people. And so everybody is supposed to think about their white privilege and what it means. And the problem with that is, why? So it's one thing to have realized that racism is a bad thing and to check yourself for it. That's fine. But this particularly stringent, Zen-like, frankly, religious version of it, why? What is it for? If you think about a Black person having problems, say, for example, in Milwaukee or Madison, what does the white person sitting in their kitchen exploring their complicitness in a racist system have to do with helping that person? Why is that necessary before even that white person in the kitchen might want to pitch in and help? Because nobody was really saying this so vociferously before about a couple years ago. So that's my issue. The third wave is more of a virtue signaling exercise than a progressive, civically concerned activity. And that worries me.
And you tie this to a religion, that this is religion-like. What do you, you know, how do you see religion in this?
Well, how about this? You think about the fact that in big cities with a large Black population across the country, every summer, a few hundred often Black boys die because they're shooting each other for various reasons. Now, there are reasons for that. Racism in the past is some of it. But to look at it now and to say racism, as if that's the solution to that particular problem, as if that helps the mother who's crying over the casket of her child, think about how little sense that makes. And yet that's what we're supposed to do today because there's a kind of suspension of disbelief. There's a religion where your job is to show that you know racism exists. It's the equivalent of showing that you have faith in Jesus if you're a devout Christian. In the new religion, you're showing that you know racism exists, not doing anything about it, just showing that you know it exists. And it means you can carefully, almost recreationally, point it out everywhere, But often that thing that you point out has nothing to do with solving a real problem for real people. It's a religious kind of belief where you leave logic behind, and in a way you just believe. That's part of most religions, that you have to leave logic behind to an extent. This new religion has that component in it, but it creates a kind of heartlessness in a way. Boys are killing each other, and you look at it and you think, this is a racist America. Isn't that a little abstract? And isn't that actually a little unfeeling? Only a patch on your normal mental processes would make that seem natural.
It was interesting what you saw on college campuses that you bring up. And I'm based here, UW-Madison's campus, not a part of the academy. I can feel it around me. You're at Columbia. You bring up this meeting of Northwestern University's law school last year where professors stood up and denounced themselves as not only harboring privilege, but as being outright racists. What was this moment about, and what did it accomplish?
That moment was theater. That moment was kabuki, and it accomplished nothing. Nothing whatsoever. And yet, at that very law school and the surrounding environment, all sorts of things have gone on where white people have been made to feel really bad and have been forced to call themselves racist and to call other people racists. And it illustrates a problem we have, which is that most people don't think that way. This new prosecutorial religion that I call the elect, most people don't agree with it. But the thing is, if you don't do what the elect want, the elect, like everybody else, are on social media. And they call you a white supremacist on Twitter. That's the main thing. You get called a white supremacist on Twitter. Because we've made so much progress, this is why I mentioned the progress in the book to make this point. We've made so much progress that most people would almost rather be called a pedophile than a racist. That was not true in 1960. That was not true in 1970. But that means that if somebody calls you a white supremacist on Twitter, you were shaken so much to your socks that most people would rather pretend to agree with, for example, this kabuki. You've got groceries to buy, you've got hobbies, you've got a family. But it means that there is this reign of terror. I don't mean physical, but I mean emotional and cognitive, that a certain small number of, I think, frankly, misled people are wielding over all of the rest of us who are trying to do real things. I think it's a very unpretty situation because there's a fakeness. Almost every one of those professors who stood up and called themselves a racist didn't really believe it, but they felt that if they didn't do it with all the other professors, they would be hounded and called white supremacists on Twitter and perhaps lose their jobs. Is that progress? And what in God's name does it do for Black people who need help in real places?
John McWhorter with us, author of Woke Racism, and taking your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. Patty is joining us from Madison. Hi, Patty. You've been a public school teacher for decades now.
That's correct. I'm retired. 35 years of teaching and heavy concentration of Black kids and other kids that need special help. And what I wanted to say was I just feel like it's been so obvious that we've had the problem of Black student achievement, you know, where the Black kids and other kids, too, are having problems with, you know, reading scores. I mean, it's pretty dramatic. Third grade reading scores, eighth grade reading scores, high school graduation, et cetera. You know, and I think, you know, I've worked in programs that have worked with kids like that. And I think how in the heck is becoming anti-racist going to help these kids learn to do math or to read or to graduate? I mean, to me, it's like they need reading programs. They need math programs. They need, you know, high school to be rearranged so that they have more vocational learning. Get kids learning barbershop. Get kids learning, you know, car mechanics, stuff like that, rather than everybody takes college prep. I mean, at some point, that's just nobody's going to go to school. They don't want to do that. It's not because it's racist.
Patty, thank you. It sounds like John McWhorter, Patty has read your book with the solutions. Go ahead.
Patty said everything that I would say, and in a way she sounds better saying it than I do because she's been out on the ground. Yeah, there you go. And I only ask you to consider that the hip anti-racist position about those kids is to say that it's white to be dedicated to the written word and that Black people are oral, and that it's white to expect Black kids to actually get the answer when they do math, and that the proper anti-racist teaches math as based on exploring the answer, talking around it, being cooperative, exploring the subject of math rather than learning how to get the answers. This is in real documents that are being examined by boards of education in many states. It won't do. Frankly, it sounds like something Strom Thurmond would have loved. It's the same thing. Just because it comes from a modern white person now who isn't in the South doesn't mean that it isn't the same sort of thing. So yeah, what Patty said.
Author John McWhorter, written many books, new one called Woke Racism. What do terms like dismantling structures or social justice mean to you? How do you think we should talk to kids, teach kids about racism? What gets lost in anti-racism messages coming from corporations, coming from politicians? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with John McWhorter after a news update here on the Ideas Network. We're examining the debates over racism and white supremacy and what it means to work at being anti-racist. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author John McWhorter introduces us to what he calls the elect, that anti-racism has become a religion and that it's damaging and demeaning to Black Americans. And he asks this question, how about doing work motivated by something other than working out feelings of guilt and feeling superior to other people while enjoying a sense of belonging? Have you read books like White Fragility and How to Be an Anti-Racist? What did you think? Join in, 800-642-1234. John McWhorter, Associate Professor of Linguistics at Columbia. His new book is Woke Racism, and he's with us for the hour. Let's bring on another caller now. Chris is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Chris. What would you like to bring up?
Well, hi. You know, living in Milwaukee, I really could talk about systemic racism, like a white state legislature not allowing my city to ban guns. But I want to talk about racist people. A couple of years ago, I took part in a weekend retreat in central Wisconsin, and we had to be told that in the future, we had to end the final day well before dark, because those people in the group who were Black, who were African-American, all had to caravan home because they literally feared for their lives driving through central Wisconsin. I'm going to call that racism. Thank you for listening.
Chris, thank you. John, what are your thoughts there on that anecdote?
Well, I'm not from Wisconsin, so I don't know the territory, but the question is, was there such a danger? Maybe there was. I mean, if there wasn't, then we can say that people are overgeneralizing. And of course, that does happen. People aren't perfect and racism is real. If you ask me, racism is never going to be completely gone. I'd like it if it were, but I'm not sure that we can completely get rid of it. But I don't know. And I mean, literally, I don't know. I don't know Wisconsin, but if the neighborhoods were dangerous, then to point it out and act on it is not in itself a racist act just because it seems like it's a criticism of the Black people in the neighborhood, if I understand what the idea here was. It doesn't have to be a criticism of the people, but if there was a danger, why are we supposed to pretend that there wasn't? There are times when I think questions like that need to be asked.
We slightly touched on cancel culture that isn't just about taking down celebrities who don't follow in lockstep with the anti-racism solidarity, but you read about how just everyday people with no celebrity status whatsoever have lost their jobs over something that they say or do that rubs the wrong way. One of those examples that stuck out to me is the MIT chaplain, Catholic chaplain, who, after the murder of George Floyd, you explain how Father Maloney explored how we should make some attempt at understanding the humanity of officers who kill someone. What happened in that case of Father Maloney?
Well, there were people who were members of his flock who decided that he was, in some implicational sense, condoning officers who do things like murdering George Floyd, which of course was a terrible thing, because he said something other than racism, 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 and in line with his profession and his faith, was trying to understand all people and see the good in all people, he was fired from his position. That was a religious kind of excommunication. That was somebody being treated as a heretic. And notice, it doesn't even quite make sense. Why would Father Maloney not think about exploring the heart of police officers as well as the people who they torture or murder? And that is a real problem. But still, he was trying to be what his profession is supposed to be. And he was just overturned. And if you actually read the text, which since then have been, you know, discreetly deleted, but the text that went around among those people, it's obvious that they're like the people who, you know, condemned Galileo. The idea was, oh, listen to this. Well, it's time to get rid of him. They really sounded like conspirators. And I'm sure they thought they were doing the right thing. But this is a religion. And my problem with it being a religion is that in this country, the last time I checked, we don't let religion run the state. And yet that's what's beginning to happen.
What are your tips? What's your advice for surviving cancel culture, especially when the hate is happening online? It's coming in a barrage.
Yeah, it's at the point where we, and I mean Black people as well as white people who come into the sights of this sort of thing, have to start realizing that there can be worse things than being called a white supremacist on Twitter. The people who do this sort of thing get their way because they say you're a white supremacist on Twitter, and that scares everybody, so everybody just stands and salutes and, you know, stays in line. That's not the way it should be. I think that the pandemic confused an awful lot of us, especially since most of this was not in person. And we got into the habit of letting these people get their way by calling us dirty names. They need to learn to understand that when they yell racist, they don't just get what they want. The only way they're going to learn that is if a critical mass of people, if it's within their wherewithal, if professionally they can accommodate it, critical mass of people have to start saying, no, I don't think I am a racist. I actually think I am an anti-racist. I don't think our organization is racist. We're not going to center everything our organization or school does on anti-racism. No, we're not going to do that. And you can yell as loud as you want. We're going to keep doing what we're doing and look them in the eye. And to be honest, I think that kind of person would then sit back down at the table with the rest of us. I don't want to push them out a window the way they want to push us. I want them to just sit back down and be one of many contributors to our ideas about how to progress and how to create change. But we can't just give them everything they want. And that's what's beginning to happen.
What is attractive about this new religion, especially for some people of color, for Black people?
Well, for white people, it's about feeling like you're ahead of the curve, mm-hmm. and then there's a sense of social membership. And for Black people, it's actually something very sad. If you are part of Black America, there might be a part of you that feels an insecurity about race because of the way Black people were treated for so very, very long, and sometimes, people would argue, are treated now. So there's an insecurity, and one way that you can assuage it is by the victimization complex. And that's something that all people do. There's a kind of person who takes on being a victim as a badge of status. That's something psychologists are familiar with. Black America ODs on that. And it's because sometimes it can be hard to have a sense of worth apart from that. And so it means that for Black people, being part of this religion can feel good because it gives you a sense of purpose. It gives you a sense of belonging. It gives you a sense of a ground beneath your feet. If you're a victim, then it means that actually getting through life is a kind of a victory for you because you're dealing with this racism that's always around you. You're always pointing out what other people are doing wrong to you. And as a result, you have a sense of purpose, and it frankly makes you feel kind of good about yourself. This is a human type. This is not only a Black type, but we overdo it. And so I think that's why it's attractive. If your life is actually going more or less okay, that's what's required, then to, I hate to say it, but to pretend a kind of victimhood can be a kind of a balm. And that's been a problem in Black America for frankly decades at this point.
Columbia University linguist John McWhorter with us, author of a new book, Woke Racism, How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. You can join in 800-642-1234. Tony is joining us from Milwaukee. Tony, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi. So I'm happy to have happened across this program. It's definitely put some words to what I've been feeling about sort of the hollowness. I myself am a black woman, business owner, and I often my business boomed at the expense of black trauma being doled out at the height of this. And I got called to be a speaker for so many things, often not paid. And I really felt like I understood how this worked. Like, it feels good as a black person to get all of the things that have happened to you off your chest and to have people listen. And I'm sure it feels good for them to say, see, I'm not racist. We've checked off the list. We've got a black speaker, and then go about their lives and do nothing. So although I understand and I do think most people have good intentions in mind, it's just I feel like black trauma is for sale right now. And but there's it's kind of hollow. There's nothing else done after we talk about how we got here, after we talk about the white supremacy that is, I believe, ingrained in our country. There's nothing done about it afterwards.
Tony, thank you so much. You bring up so much black trauma for sale right now. John McWhorter.
Yeah, that. Exactly. Mm-hmm. There is too much of it being just a kind of a little show. You know, as far back as 1990, I remember I was talking to somebody who was active in the black community in East Palo Alto, which was and I think is a troubled, underserved community, and back then a mostly black community. And she was saying something that you heard people like her say often, even back then. This is 1990, so the grand civil rights victories are now 25 years back, just 25. She said, we've talked enough, it's time to do things. And that was kind of a mantra, we've talked enough. Now, here we are 30 years later, and we're being told that what we really need is to talk, or that white people need to talk to each other. No, it's a little too easy, and more to the point, it's not necessary. You can create change without creating this Zen-like state of understanding your complicity. That's not how anybody has ever gotten ahead in the history of our species. Nobody has proposed that until it was about black people in the late 20th century. It's time to stop talking. We're supposed to go out and do things, and not based on a simplistic idea that everything is racist or anti-racist, and that any problem you see is due to something called racism, and you're supposed to stick your lower lip out and be angry at the racism as if it was a person who was a racist. That's not how you create change. Nobody who was doing civil rights in the 60s would understand what that had to do with helping real people.
Columbia University, John McWhorter's new book called Woke Racism, as we talk about this issue in America, with your thoughts along the way, what you have experienced in Milwaukee and elsewhere. We'll be back in a minute with John McWhorter here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Columbia University linguist John McWhorter, who makes the argument that anti-racism has become a force in public life that functions more like a religion. John McWhorter's latest book is called Woke Racism, and he's with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring on another caller, Jonathan, now in Madison. Jonathan, hi, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say I agree with some of the points that your guest is making, but I think he's kind of missing the fact that it's like people use racism as a tool to try to gain things, but at the end of the day, it's still prevalent. So I just feel like you're doing people of color, black, white, and different, a disservice by trying to absolve people's feelings of the fact of what the racism has done to people of color and black people specifically.
John McWhorter.
Yeah, I get that. I understand what he means. And I'm not trying to absolve. My point, maybe it's kind of a fine point. I think that white people are aware enough. Sometimes we talk about this as if the conversation about racism as something other than the N-word and burning a cross on somebody's lawn is only 2 or 3 years old. It's as if we haven't been having the same conversation really since the late 1960s. I'm not sure where that idea comes from, but I just feel, how aware do white people need to be given the amount of awareness that there is at this point? And so, yeah, people will differ on that. There are people who think that there needs to be more awareness than there was 10 years ago. I'm not sure I understand what the argument there is.
Mary now in Appleton. Mary, hi, what is your question?
Yes, good morning. Listen, I don't want to be I hope you aren't offended, but I just need to be blunt about some things because I have a black brother-in-law and a biracial niece that I totally adore. So we have these conversations all the time, so please forgive my bluntness. But I am wondering if because of most white people don't understand, you know, basically the problems in the past of slavery. I'm wondering if...
Oh, Mary, you're breaking up a little bit. Hey, Mary, can you just say that one more time, the question, because you're breaking up?
Yes, I'm just curious if there is a perpetuating situation where black people are getting, you know, black people are perpetuating a situation that they can't get out of. And just by the messaging from their parents, their grandparents about slavery, their feelings of victimizing, the being the victim. And like I said, I don't think I'm a racist. I adore my brother-in-law. He's black, and I adore my biracial niece. So this is just conversations we have, and my elephant's been out of the living room for years. So it's kind of like cutting to the chase here. Are the black people perpetuating their situation and white people going, there's another black person committing a crime. We see them on, you know, the news all the time. They're always black. Would that be a possibility or something when you said something about being victimized or they feel victimized? Are they perpetuating this situation?
Mary, thanks. Let's get John to jump in here. John, go ahead.
Well, I think if I understand what Mary is saying, I think that this is what she's perceiving. And Mary, you know, you're not a racist. And I know there's some people listening to this who think that I'm absolving you or something like that. But no, I'm trying to use a definition of racism that makes immediate sense among real people in the real world where we've got things to do. But the point is, what you're seeing, I think, is that in the black community, only since the late 20th century, this is only about 50 years old, there is a sense that the most urgent thing that we have to share with the rest of America is the victimhood that we suffered in the past and the obstacles that there are for us today. With the idea being that those obstacles mean that only so much can be expected of us. So the idea isn't there are these obstacles, we'd like some help with them, but we can do the best that we can even with an imperfect world. Instead, we're supposed to talk about the obstacles. That's a new way of being a subordinated group. And some people seem to think that because people were descendants of slaves and because of Jim Crow and maybe because of automation in the late 20th century, that it somehow makes sense. But I'm not sure. I feel like we're taught that yes, we can't is the proper mantra for Black America, that that's what smart Black people are supposed to say. Yes, we can't. But ultimately, it gets to the point where that doesn't really help anybody. And if you see disproportionate crime among young Black boys, to say that the reason that they're doing those things is because white people don't like them, or to say something abstract like America doesn't love them enough, one, it's fake, and two, it doesn't solve any problems.
Let's shift the conversation now to remedies, to solutions. You have a program for how to address the legacies of racism. It's a 3-point plan. It is short. It starts with ending the war on drugs. What would this do?
What that would do is it would mean there is no tempting black market that you can make your living or half of a living with if you go to a bad school in a bad neighborhood and you're not sure what to do after you're out of school. It's a very understandable temptation. If there were no such thing as a black market for hard drugs, then the men who drift into selling them and then often going to prison or dying and not being there for their kids, this is something I would do. I can easily imagine doing that if I grew up in a community like that. But if that weren't there, then those men would get legal work. And the way I know that is because that's the way it was before the war on drugs. And that means that there's the other plank in my plan, which is that we make vocational school more available and better so that those same men can go have middle-class lives, getting training, doing something that they can sell to the rest of society. That would change Black America in one generation if those two things happen.
Yeah, let's look at that a little bit more, that pushing people away, pushing Black Americans away from going to four-year colleges and really trying to push the vocational learning. You're there at an Ivy League school, a PhD from Stanford. Why focus away from four-year college learning?
Because I grew up in a leafy middle-class neighborhood and I'm a hopeless nerd. And so I wanted to go to college. That's the kind of person I am. Not everybody wants to go to college. And frankly, not everybody should. The idea that college, 4 years of college is normal, that started after World War II. Nobody would have understood that in, say, 1935. And so if somebody from a community like that wants to go to college, then certainly they should. But that shouldn't be thought of as the default. The default for many would be to spend 2 years getting training in, for example, being an electrician. Or you know how people like us are always, you know, we're marveling at how much money plumbers make? Mm-hmm. Why couldn't some of these men become plumbers? Because yes, plumbers do make a thoroughly decent living. And that would be a nice step. Any of those guys who want to go to college, great. There are colleges they can go to. But I think just as many would like to get training in something they can sell to society and get going with it as soon after high school as possible. This is real world pragmatism here, as opposed to the idealism that I think we're often encouraged to settle for.
Number three in the plan, to teach phonics. What would this do?
Well, that seems so minor, I know, but if somebody isn't taught to read properly, then school is a chore by the time they're eight and you've have probably lost them for good. And if you're trying to teach somebody to read, if they come from a middle-class book-lined home where reading is very much in the air, you just kind of learn to read by osmosis. You just watch a light bulb go off. If you don't grow up in that kind of home, if the printed page is something you might mainly encounter in school, you need to be taught reading by sounding out the words. And it might surprise you to know that there's a whole philosophy among education people that that's not true, that that's too sterile or that's too severe, that you have to teach even poor kids how to read with all of these, you know, quote unquote, holistic methods where teaching them what the sounds of the letters are is only one part. No, it's been proven scientifically again and again. Poor kids do better when they're taught, frankly, how to read. And I think Black kids suffer disproportionately from any idea otherwise. So my third plank, yeah, is teach reading right.
Few seconds left here. Where do you want to see the conversation about racism go now in America?
There. It should be about the war on drugs, vocational school, and phonics. And I know that seems sterile. Seems like I'm trying to pull some sort of stunt.
Your list isn't long enough, John.
Yeah, that's what people say. But I think those three things would solve it, including the police. If you do those three things, then everybody would encounter the cops less. So, yeah, I think it is long enough.
John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
John McWhorter, Associate Professor of Linguistics at Columbia University, author of many books, including Woke Racism, his new one, How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.